This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. To those of us who came of age in the 60s, the SDS, Students for a Democratic Society, was a part of our consciousness. Perhaps you were on a college or university campus and part of the rising student movement, fueled, among many things, by the war in Vietnam, the war on poverty, and the civil rights and women's rights movement. Perhaps you were still in grade school or high school, as I was. But nonetheless, you knew something was happening, and it felt important. It has been 50 years since members of the newly formed Students for a Democratic Society came together in Port Huron for a retreat. 5 days later, they had produced the Port Huron Statement, spelling out their vision of participatory democracy, how and why students would take part in the many left and liberal causes. To mark the 50th anniversary of that historic manifesto of the SDS, the University of Michigan's holding a 3-day conference exploring the Port Huron Statement. Joining us today on Stateside is the writer who drafted and finalized the Port Huron Statement and who has spent his life since then as an activist, a writer, a teacher, a legislator. Welcome to Tom Hayden. Good to have you with us today,
sir. I'm delighted to be here in Ann Arbor. I love Ann Arbor, and I'm proud to have graduated from the university, and I'm proud that they're taking ownership of this unique and historical movement, the SDS, that arose here and went through several phases. And I think it's important that all the phases had something to do with Ann Arbor. Even Bill Ayers of the Weather Underground, who was the last phase of a 8-year period.
8 years, wow.
9 years.
Yeah.
I remember him, Billy Ayers. He was a younger generation SDSer who was very active in an alternative school in Ann Arbor. Mm-hmm. And then in the middle years, Ann Arbor produced Carl Oglesby, who was one of the great orators of the time. He was a playwright. He was a graduate student in defense research. And he helped lead the movement against the Vietnam War. Port Huron was like the cradle,
mm-hmm.
The golden
early the birth,
years.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And but really, when you think about it, Ann Arbor or Michigan maybe had to be the cradle of it all, because no one quite has put their finger on why this was inspired here in the Midwest and not in the ghettos of New York or the Bay Area. I'm not sure that I know, but there's something about the place. And so it's, I think, very important that the university addresses the fact that this happened here and not shy away from it.
I want to have you take us back a little bit. Your time growing up in Royal Oak and going to Dondero High and then coming to U of M, all of that happening in the Eisenhower 50s was very much an era not about students as activists. So where and when did that activist spark happen for you?
Well, I would say I was one of those idealists and nonconformists who read James Joyce. And if you look at the Stephen Dedalus character, he says some very dreamy things. I remember the most important thing about Port Huron is that we tried to articulate at Port Huron what James Joyce called the uncreated conscience of our generation.
That phrase struck a chord for you as you read it as a young guy.
Yeah, but I was also influenced by the late sociologist C. Wright Mills, who taught us about the power elite in a sophisticated way. He taught us about the dangers of apathy in a mass society. We were very influenced by the French philosopher Albert Camus, who had written a book, The Plague, about when you're in the midst of such suffering, the only thing to do is to take action. We were influenced by the Beat Generation, by Howl, and by On the Road. There was Arnold Kaufman, who gave us the phrase participatory democracy, which came down through time from John Dewey. We can overdo the generation gap thesis. That was certainly true enough. But there was also a generational exchange going on in Ann Arbor between our professors and ourselves. And above all, we were moved by the idea from the black sit-in movement, the Southern movement, which I was part of, mm-hmm. that there was a purpose to life that was worth dying for. Most of us were wandering the campus, you know, having no particular purpose at all. My purpose was at the Daily to become a journalist, which meant get a byline. Mm-hmm. So if I interviewed Martin Luther King, which I did, it was to get a byline. Mm-hmm. And it took me a while to realize that it was kind of...
It was a little superficial.
Shallow of me to be looking at this man who had a purpose, whereas my miniature purpose was to get a job on a newspaper. It was a time, it didn't last so long, but many thousands of people, maybe millions, felt that they were going to devote the rest of their lives to these causes. Hmm. It's hard to imagine.
Because we don't have that sense today.
We have certainly have it, but on a lesser scale, mm-hmm. yeah.
Well, in fact, one of the lines...
And it's less affordable if you're an Ann Arbor student.
That's true. That's so true. One of the lines in the Port Huron statement that struck a chord for me is you talk about that yours, and here's the quote, may be the last generation in the experiment with living. That fear of doomsday was so much informed our lives in that era. Do you think there's a similar fear with after 9/11
global
for today's...
Warming.
Global warming? Is that the fear today?
Well, a good, you know, scientific approach taken by a professor here today, Henry Pollack in Ann Arbor. If you read the scientific findings carefully and you're a young person, you have to conclude that the world as we know it is going to end in your lifetime. That plus a bad economy puts you very much in the position we were. I actually think global warming is harder to manage than the nuclear arms race, but they're both life-threatening specters. We're talking about all life, the wellsprings of life. And if you combine that with the pressure students are under with loans and indebtedness and the job outlook, these are pretty and inequality. These are similar challenges to what we faced, and the fact that we were able to go on is, I think, the good news, because these can be really numbing. I mean, if you tell a kid in a classroom that the world is going to end, the polar bears are going to be the first sign of it, with the Jersey Shore is another mm-hmm. sign of it. It's coming. It can be so paralyzing that you fall into an egomaniacal quest for wealth.
Yes.
And build a moat around your life.
Yeah.
Or an existential despair, and you start rereading the Beat Poets and put on your black turtleneck sweater.
Sackcloth and ashes.
yeah. It's to say, hey— let's do something about it is really a radical choice when you think about it compared to the challenge. It's so immense.
You made the same radical choice in 62
right.
coming together in Port Huron. I have a question. As you were together, how many of you were there drafting that statement when you went to that retreat in Port
Huron? I'm going to speak on this subject tonight because I am an archaeological dig. I am a primary source, and I can tell you I don't know.
Okay.
Because there was some coming and going, but it was in the range of 60.
All right. Was there a sense of agreement? Was there dissension? We hear, for example, when the Founding Fathers were drafting the Constitution, there was a lot of dissension. So what was the mood?
Similar to the Founding Fathers and Mothers, I suppose. There was the specter of the empire out there. We knew we were in trouble. What I would say is that it started off on in a spirit of being completely overwhelmed with the scale of the project starting on the first night, but we found a participatory way to handle it. We took the 60 pages or 25,000 words, and we broke it into sections, you know, like students, values, morality, politics, foreign policy, the economy, the university. And we formed groups of 12 who would take the draft that I wrote, mm-hmm. and they would debate it, and it was ambitious stuff. What is human nature? And then they would decide how to revise the draft, and come back in a general assembly, and the workshops would propose their changes, and people would discuss that and make accommodations. And this went on for 5 days. And when we were done, it was quite telling. People felt that they'd gone through like a religious conversion. It was a hugely moving experience to feel that we were giving birth to something. And we were too exhausted to vote on the final version. So we adopted a good technique. It was improvised. We said, we affirm this as a living document for future generations, and Tom should go and finish it, finalize it. So it was never clear.
So you were saying this was a living thing. This was not carved
living
in
document.
Granite. Living document. If you're just joining us, we are having a discussion with Tom Hayden, who is here back at U of M, back in Ann Arbor, to really commemorate the 50th anniversary of the Port Huron Statement, and talking about the roots of the student activism movement, and SDS was at the head of all of that. I want to ask you, Tom, because you do say you are an archaeological dig, and part of archaeology is learning from the past and applying it to the present and hopefully the future. What are the activists of 2012? What can they learn from the activists of the 60s?
I think if you study this period, it's infinitely deep and fascinating, but you can get lost in it. I mean, all you really need to know is go and read the statement itself. There's a book out that I've edited that has the reflections of 12 of us. It's called Inspiring Participatory Democracy. Secondly, I think that the idea of participatory democracy is transcendent. You see it as a first principle of Occupy Wall Street, mm-hmm. September statement of last year. And why is that? Because if the representatives we elect are unable to deliver, and we're feeling a moral injury, and we have specific grievances, whether it's the right to vote or reform Wall Street, it's a foregone prediction of mine that people will go into the streets, or they will try to claim dignity for themselves in some way through direct action, community organizing, joining political campaigns at the grassroots level. That's what participatory democracy is. And it's sad that we thought it wasn't radical enough by the late 60s. Mm. It's very inclusive. You said, how did the statement get written with so many diverse viewpoints? Well, I had to draft it, turn it over to other people. It became organically theirs. And you'll find if you parse it carefully that it includes viewpoints, because we were trying to build a coalition that was open-ended that would bring in other groups.
Sure.
So it was not a dogmatic line to tell you these are the steps to take.
It was fluid.
It was fluid. It was organic. And it said basically, none of these fine things will happen unless you feel that your dignity requires that you participate, and we design a society where everybody's dignity is respected. It's voting is important, but more give and take in the family, neighborhood councils to protect against overdevelopment. Students to not just be passive recipients of knowledge from their professors, but to participate in a creative learning process. The idea of participatory democracy is wider than the ballot box and is indispensable. If you think about the things we're proud of in America, they inevitably come from participatory democracy and the insistence of people who were considered controversial in the time, starting with the Bill of Rights, starting with the First Amendment.
Tom Hayden, a pleasure to talk with you.
Always a pleasure to meet you. Thank you so much.
The three-day conference Exploring the Port Huron Statement continues through tomorrow. Tom Hayden will be the keynote speaker at 7:30 tonight, and you can go to the stateside page at michiganradio.org, where we've placed a link to the full schedule of speakers and events.